worked your health in Germany, in your sobriety in the dangerous, uncertain situation. And though this new sobriety can be seen in many ways, in Brecht's theater to a certain extent, it can be seen in advertising, in the new industrial design. It can above all be seen in the new architecture, in the new school of architecture, which is known as the Bauhaus. Founded directly after the war in 1919 in the classical center of Germany in Weimar, the Bauhaus, founded as a socialist activity and even to a certain extent as a communist activity as well. The idea is closely related, in fact, to the Marxist Renaissance, the idea of totality, which I talked to you about once before, when we talked about Lukács and people like that. That is to say that art and life should be a totality, and therefore that architecture should be a totality, and building where people live and work, and therefore there can be no distinctions between craftsmanship and architecture and painting. That is, everything in a building, whether it is the paintings, the mosaics, the craftsman that goes into it, everything must be a one unity. And therefore, this school of architecture employed famous painters, above all Klee, one of the most famous abstract painters, Feininger, all sorts of famous painters, for mosaics, above all for mosaics, and craftsmen, masons, and others, as well as designers and architects. And the students in the schools had to learn everything. They had to learn to be painters, they had to learn to be masons, they had to learn to be bricklayers, and they learned to be architects. This architecture was a total work of art, was a totality. Now that was something new. And indeed, there was here with this socialism a kind of urge, if you like, a kind of urge to be craftsmen and not to be professional architects. In a sense, the Bauhaus denied that there were such things as professional architects and that instead everyone was a craftsman, a kind of idea of abolishing the difference between workers of the brain and workers of the hand. Workers of the brain and workers of the hand were supposed to be the same. A reaction. A reaction against professionalism. A reaction against the division of labor, in the Marxist sense. Action for a totality against the division of labor. But together, of course, with that, and reaction against the bourgeois style for simplicity and above all, of course, for functionalism against the kind of furniture that you saw in Jenny Tribal. The founders of the Bauhaus, above all Gropius and Mies van der Rohe, believed they believed the Corbusier also was a part of it really well he did that Mies van der Rohe and Gropius of Havel believed in functionalism. Functionalism bows to make a connection, as it were, with something that people could understand, both to get away from the Jenny Tribal kind of neo-romantic and baroque, or as we say in Germany, Biedermeier, a kind of furniture, and to functionalism. Ludwig Mies van der Rohe's working thesis, as he put them out in 1923, promptly after the founding, I think make it very clear. Again, partly inspired by the Bolshevik Revolution. partly inspired by something we call Russian constructivism, partly inspired by this. We reject, he said, all aesthetic speculation, all doctrine, and all formalism. That is to say, we reject all theory, really, all theory that is not tied to craftsmanship, all theory that isn't tied to work, all theory that isn't tied to functionalism. Architecture is the will of the age, conceived in spatial terms. Not yesterday, not tomorrow, only today can be given form. Only architecture creates form out of nature. That is our work. In other words, it must be genuine, it must be natural, and what that meant in practice, it must be functional. Away with ornamentation. Away with all ornamentation. Functionalism and the reaction against the bourgeois, and again, towards craftsmanship, towards an abolition of the division of labor. And with functionalism came abstract art as part of this functionalism as well. As Miss van der Rohe continues under the heading office building. The office building is a house, a work of organization, of clarity and economy. And here you have the other slogans against the new romanticism. Clarity and economy. Bright, wide workrooms. Easy to oversee, undivided. In other words, light, glass. The idea is again, light at the workplace to make work agreeable, light. Reinforced concrete buildings are skeletal buildings. No armored turrets, no Baroque ornaments, a construction of girders alone. A building must consist of skins and bones. Now this is a very violent reaction against Jenny Tribal, a very violent reaction against the furniture of the bourgeoisie, towards functionalism. A building must be of skin and bones, simplicity of materials and simple lines, which is what you have here. Now why? Why again? Let me make it clear. First of all, revolutionary. Revolutionary. No division of work. Everything by craftsmen. No, nothing complicated. Nothing that cannot be understood in the first glance. No bourgeois comforts. No bourgeois division of labor. The architect must be craftsman, painter. Secondly, as a part of the new sobriety, the age requires function, functionalism, function, skeleton, everything stripped down to the bare necessity. And then the bare necessity means light and air, close to nature. It took off what we call the Garden City movement from the 18th century, the Back to Nature movement we've talked about before. It was so strong after the war, and transposed it upon industrial scenery. The Nazis would do the same. They transposed it upon the industrial scenery. That is why the glass, light and air was of vast importance. Gropius himself summarized it again. That will make it still clearer. The new architecture, what are its characteristics? A manifold simplicity arrived at by deliberate restriction to certain basic forms used repetitively. Why used repetitively? Economy of material. Cheap building. Cheap building. Not a lot of money. Not co-opted by monopoly capitalism. But cheap building. Cheap material. Genuine material. Cheap material. And the structural subdivision of buildings according to their nature and that of the streets. And here I have the third reason. A building must be part of the totality. And the totality is the street, is the city, is the simplicity of the street and the simplicity of the city. This you will see in tomorrow night's documentary. In tomorrow night's documentary, look for the simplicity of the streets and the simplicity of the buildings themselves. To put it another way, the Bauhaus becomes the dominance of form over content. This is really form. This is really all form. Simplicity, structure, craftsmen, these are forms. No doctrine, no theory. So the content, in a sense, is left wide open in the end. But there's something else involved, and that is the fourth thing, a clinging to rationality. That, again, is important because it means to keep control. In the final resort, the Bauhaus architecture is a part of this great problem of the Weimar Republic, of keeping rationality in front of irrationality. The irrationality of the right, the left stressed more and more, keeping control, keeping rationality. And what is more rational than the clear and simple forms of the Bauhaus, the totality of the Bauhaus? What was more rational? What was more equal? Now, the problem involved in the Bauhaus, we see, of course, very clearly, that this dominance of forms, this, if you like, control, became dominance. In the end, Mies van der Rohe built buildings, of course, which were dominant buildings, not of control, but dominant. The ones that you probably know best are those apartment buildings on the lake in Chicago, on the north side, near the university. Those apartment buildings in Chicago are Mies van der Rohe apartment buildings. But if you know the new graduate school at Harvard, which is a Gropius graduate school, but in the end, of course, the entire modern architecture is Bauhaus architecture. And you might ask, why was it so easily co-opted to capitalism? Well, I think there are several reasons. First of all, it was cheap building, and therefore it was attractive. Also, to builders would make big profits building these cheap buildings. They lend themselves to ready-made buildings, to ready-made pieces like Van Fleck, which is in fact the best example of Bauhaus we have. Is Van Fleck, which was built with ready-made building components. The others might as well have them. Second of all, of course, it becomes an architecture of dominance. And the interesting thing is that those who refuse to go along have lasted much better. For example, the architect Erich Mendelssohn, who was a romantic, who refused to go along, who built buildings in the romantic style, has lasted much better. He didn't build anything here. Yes, he built the main synagogue in St. Louis, which is one of the most beautiful liturgical buildings I know. But he built mainly in Berlin and then in Jerusalem, the post office and the bank in the center of Jerusalem, a Mendelssohn building. They are lyrical buildings with lyrical undulating forms. And they have, of course, lasted much better because today there's a reaction against this, and we again want ornaments, and we again, I suppose, dislike these blank walls which this architecture goes into, but the blank walls which were supposed to be decorated, of course, by the artist. Remember, this was a total work of art. So blank walls didn't frighten them. Blank walls were just for the architect's artist, the other the architect's craft. So they didn't frighten them. But obviously, the Bauhaus, typically now Le Corbusier and Mies van der Rohe, then built for the Italian fascists. Not for the Nazis, but neoclassicism. Nazi neoclassicism isn't that far removed. But in fact, the Bauhaus built then for Italian fascism, and the most beautiful building of the Bauhaus ever did is the Central Railway Station in Rome. I would suppose that was built and designed under the fascists. I suppose it's one of the most beautiful buildings that exists, if you've been there, as the Central Railway Station in Rome. In any case, they designed. And in the end, of course, it made no difference. It was co-opted easily, but it is a style, of course, which has lasted and has been, in a way, if you like, the most lasting legacy of Weimar, and I suppose the most difficult of troubles. But I think you can see very easily how this fits in with the new sobriety. That this is a sobriety, a new kind of a sobriety. And it is of one piece, if you like, and to a certain extent, certainly of one piece, with the retention of reason, with this problem which is always a Weimar problem, the problem that I might call the problem of culture and rationality, the awareness of the growing irrationality of the right, the attempt to contain it, and to emphasize reason, something the liberals did by trying to use the French example, as I told you, going back to the Enlightenment. Something Brecht did, if you like, by trying to transform the theater into an educational event, where men, the audience, has to use his reason to follow a Brecht play, to follow the left political theater, is supposed to activate your reason. You are not supposed to emphasize. So you have that here too in what we discussed. And of course, in the Bauhaus as well. Now all of this was to have a very great effect on scholarship. And it was to renew above all two areas of scholarship. It founded modern art history, and it renewed modern philosophy, because the scholars involved were also aware of the problem between rationalism and irrationalism. Now, how so? How so? So I want to illustrate that by two events which again look to the future and which are of the greatest importance. After the war, in the city of Hamburg, in connection with the new University of Hamburg, A.B. Warburg founded a famous art institute, Warburg, from a famous banking family. An institute to be known as the Warburg Institute. First in Hamburg, and after the Nazis in London, where it is, of course, still today, as the Warburg Institute, I suppose, the chief institute for art history in the world, and still today on the same theory. Now, A.B. Warburg and his institute had one concern. The concern was to trace the classical heritage through art. Trace the classical heritage through art, in art history, the classical myth, in order to show the conflict between what we might call in Nietzschean terms the Apollinean and the Dionysian, the classical harmony, but also the demonic of the classic, and always the emphasis on the classical harmony. Throughout art and art history, and to do it in a way on the basis of reason. Reason as the great systematizer, and I'll come back to that again from another idea, reason as the great systematizer. The preference for classical form in this kind of art history, in this kind of tracing of themes, of major themes, through art history, led to something that is very typical for all of this, to the total reaction of the Baroque. And indeed, that became almost general. The most famous art historian of our time, Panofsky, the greatest art historian of our time, Panofsky, for example, in his famous book on iconography, that is visual images, constantly goes back to the theme of irrationalism and primitivism, and over against classicism and rationality. Always those two, in a way, are in conflict. And he rejects the Baroque because, as he puts it, it is aware of the irreconcilable contrast between rationality and irrationality, and solves it by the primacy of irrational forms. In other words, the playing of the Baroque, the kind of theater of the Baroque, that to Manofsky was the primacy of irrational form, when in reality all art should strive to the primacy of rationality, to the primacy of rational form, and that means to the primacy of reason. All art, therefore, is symbolic, and all art has with it a symbolic content, which men must grasp through reason. And this meant, to put it one step further, that what is important in art is myth, that you analyze art through analyzing myth, because what the artists represent are images. These images must be analyzed for their foundations in reality, that is, the reality of themes, in the reality of classical themes for these people, because they were in the revival in the Renaissance and in the 17th century, in the analysis of rational themes. The underlying idea, this becomes very important in philosophy too, is that history is myth, and that myth must be analyzed through reason. That is to say, everything is rational, that is the foundation. Therefore, you can rationalize every painting by Durer or anybody else rationally once you penetrate the myth. Therefore, any art history is the history of myth, is the history of mythology. And for these people, the most important theme in mythology was Greek mythology and Greek themes, which they saw in Durer, the artist of the Renaissance. Or to put it another way, every work of art has a key which unlocks its meaning. And the key which unlocks its meaning is the myth. And the myth must be unlocked in its turn by rational analysis according to the main themes and the conflict, really, of the Apollinean and the Dionysian. Yes, Mr. Stone?
Yeah, there was one other opinion was that the use of that.
Of what? They were not at all interested. They were very European, I'm afraid. But they didn't like primitivism, of course, because to them, the beginning and the end of the universe is the classics. They move in a universe of the classics, yes? And the whole Bauberg Institute and the great, and what comes out of it, which is the best art history institute today, in America, which is the Art History Department of New York University, which was entirely founded by these German refugees, is the same thing, except that in the Art History Institute in New York University and in Princeton, they use these for Christian themes. In other words, they work on the Roman basilicas to a very great extent, but the Roman basilicas are, of course, the adaptation by Christianity of pagan and classical themes. So it's very typical that one of their main, Krautheimer, who was one of the most important of these people, wrote about one of the Roman basilicas, for example, a very famous work, is very typical, because the Roman basilicas carry through the theme of classicism into Christianity. Usually in Rome, before they became Christian basilicas, they had some pagan purpose. Santa Barbara was a pagan granary, and so on. They had some pagan purpose. So one of their great themes became the tracing of classical motifs into Christian motifs. Yes? You see what I mean? But always through myths, that is to say, decoding the Christian myths according to classical motifs, which is, of course, very easy to do. As you know, they are very closely related. You see what I mean? So that it is always this kind of a classicism. Yes?
How does the Bauhaus functionalism relate to the classicism?
Well, their forms, well, of course, harmonic classical forms, symmetry and proportion is everything here. So you can say, I'm not sure how much aware they were of classical models. In this case, it's difficult to say. But what came out is, of course, you might say, has classical simplicity, symmetry, and all of that in it. And as they were educated in these forms, in school and so on, I would say yes.
You were saying that's a main element in abstract art as well.
Yes, in that kind of abstract art of finding a play at this period, yes, indeed. Yes, it's very square. It's lines, but square lines, yes? Clear forms. It isn't the kind of abstract art of what we say clicks, or what you call that in English, you drop things here. What?
Action
painting. No, it's not action painting at all. There's nothing like it. But if you see a finding a clay, which I'm sure we have in the area, I wouldn't be surprised, then you will see, you know, very clearly that they were part of the Bauhaus at first, yes? But the problem is always here, culture and rationality. Now, on the philosophical side, the best example is the most important historian and philosopher who came out of this and who was typically enough associated with the Warburg Institute, that's today forgotten, Ernst Cassirer. And he was associated with the Warburg Institute and ended up in exile teaching at Columbia, and from Columbia in the 30s and 40s having a tremendous effect on American philosophy, but again on American history as well. And in Cassirer it is the examination of myth in order to exorcise it. You can say this is true for this art history as well. The examination of myth in order to exorcise it. The irrational was examined in order to make it rational, to exorcise it and to co-opt it to rational ideas. In Cassirer's mind, everything is systematized by reason. Reason is rational. So that even the irrational, the myth, and this would be for primitive myth, but the myth of the state, nationalist. He wrote a famous book, you may know, in exile, called The Myth of the State, Nationalism. All of this, in the last degree, once you use your reason on it, once you systematize it, you exorcise the irrational elements. You make it rational, he hoped. You banish the irrational elements. And by making it rational, to a certain extent, he meant making it functional. To a certain extent, this also is part of the new sobriety. That is, the myth must be integrated into a pattern of rational thought. Now you can see in all of this, whether it is the liberals, whether it is the socialist or communist Bauhaus, whether it is these scholars who were liberal, A.B. Warburg, Panofsky, Ernst Cassirer, whether it is these scholars, what you have in all of this is very much the same. A presupposition of rationality in a world sliding evermore into irrationality. A world dominated, after all, by mass movements and mass meetings and that kind of irrationality. The problem posed is always the same, culture and rationality. How can it be maintained? Or to put it another way, how can control be maintained? Control that seems to slip away in irrationality at any moment. anymore? And the answer is very much the same. It is an answer that has to do with the new sobriety. But as it is transposed onto the world of scholarship, or the world of history, or the world of the analysis of the past, however you want to put it, as you transpose it on this world, it becomes an analysis of myths. And it were these scholars in Germany who first put forward the whole concept of myth, the whole modern concept of myth, that men live by a myth, which seems to be irrational, but which, once you decode it and analyze it, becomes rational, because the irrational has to be made rational in order to grasp it. In other words, their cognitive ideas, the ideas of understanding, are based on rationality. To understand anything, you have to have irrational understanding. Therefore, reason synthesizes everything. Therefore, myth decoded means to integrate it into the rational universe, which is your mind, which is, they believe, the decoding. And so you get, of course, the decoding, if you like, the myth in art history, let us say, of Dürer, or Rembrandt, or Rubens, or Michelangelo. You decode it. How do you decode it? You decode it by going, looking at the imagery, and connecting the imagery, if you like, to historical factors. You make it rational through history. History really makes it rational. Once you, let's say, you decode Michelangelo's famous ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, you see that he's used Greek scenes, yes? You see that certain historical currents have gotten into it, and thereby you decode of Panofsky's most important decoding, which comes in his work on Dürer, Dürer's melancholy, you decode it. Or somebody who does this today from the Warburg Institute, who indeed gave us a superb lecture 2 years ago, Dame Frances Yates, does the same thing with her studies in the Rosicrucian and mysticism. That's a very good example. She takes the most far-out thing, Rosicrucians, Giordano Bruno, who believed in all sorts of mystical ideas, and she decodes it. She shows us, let us say, how Giordano Bruno's idea that there are 23 secret worlds is really a part of the Egyptian hermeneutic tradition. Once you know that already, you can grasp it rationally. In other words, it goes on the principle that for everything there is a rational explanation. It has a double principle. On the one hand, everything is nature. People express themselves by images, by myths, which seem on the face irrational. But everything has a rational explanation once you know the historical connection. Children, it's the way this taught course is being taught. Yeah? That's why the greatest influence on me weren't some silly historians. The greatest influence on me were art historians. That kind of art historians. Yes? Were most important. What you have, therefore, is the myth and the decoding of myth. And therefore, it follows that what is important is the visual. And also you do it in literature. After all, Auerbach's Nemesis, one of the most important literary works of literary criticism, is in that way, Auerbach's Nemesis, which some of you may have read. In other words, transposed on literature, it becomes connected to acting, it becomes connected to acting out certain myths, and then you decode these myths again. This is the method. Now, what I want to say about this method is this, that this method too has a history, because it was carried to America by refugees, directly. And it became, in fact, American art history in the end, or the most important and meaningful art history of question, and English, too, in the Warburg Institute, and here in this famous department at NYU. And it became, in philosophy, vastly important through Ernst Cassirer and the School of Philosophy, which was opposed to this rather ridiculous Vienna School of Philosophy, which you can read about in the Culture of Modern Europe, that is the positivistic school. So what you really get here is something else, which I think is important to make clear, that all this trying to keep rationality acknowledges the existence of rationality. That's why it's so important. It's like the 18th century, like Voltaire, but it goes beyond it. The philosophers in the 18th century had said, irrationality exists. We don't know what to do with it, so let's ignore it. That is Voltaire. That is Diderot. That is the 18th century. The positivists said and say today, it doesn't exist. Everything can be explained rationally, on a very simple way. Logic is the thing. Logic. Everything can be contained by logic. This school, coming out of Germany and out of the peculiar German situation, says no, neither of these things are true. Neither logical positivism, which is a Viennese school of philosophy, which I will caught on only in the positivistic atmosphere of America. It wasn't that important in Vienna, but it'd be vastly important in America. They say neither is true. Both the irrational and the rational exist. Men indeed express themselves through irrationality. They were very influenced by psychoanalysis. Something, of course, that modern American positivists, either logical positivists or quantifiers, are not simply ignore. By and large. They were very influenced by psychoanalysis. And so they said, neither is true. Man expresses himself irrationally. He expresses himself through myth. But man is basically a rational creature. Therefore, the problem is to capture the irrationality rationally. Now, of course, this is an optimism, no? Of course, it has presuppositions. Of course it does that. And of course, it had a great hope that by capturing irrationality rationally, you would exorcise it. You would keep control. These were not ivory tower scholars. Their scholarship, their art history, and so on, had a point to make. A point in the present world, not just a point in the past, which they would, I think, readily admit. They are all dead now, but they would have readily admitted. Now, having said all of this, we must now come to those who did not keep control, namely to those who made a virtue of the lack of control. For in this situation, several points of view are possible. Either you want to keep control, or you make a virtue of lack of control. As Nietzsche did, in a sense, yes? You make a virtue of chaos. And here, there are two things I want to talk about. First of all, very briefly, really, some movements which simply took chaos and reveled in it. Secondly, mainly Dada, which is not really very important. Secondly, the idea that the irrationality is indeed life, it must lead, not only in nationalism, which I will leave you to read, but above all with this new idea that the poet is the Messiah, which became very important. The war. The poet is the Messiah. The creative person is the Messiah. And thirdly, of course, with the new primitivism, with the exaltation of primitivism, not African primitivism, but the barbarian, that is to say, Spain. So what we have here then is a kind of rejoicing in all this, which is part of Weimar, a culture. Not merely the episodic, not merely the cabaret, which I talked to you about. So there is something cabaret-like about Dada. Dada, I don't really want to say much, it became very popular in America again, because it is simply chaos. What is Dada? It lasted only from 1918 to 1920. It is a happening. Like these Buddhists and these others who went around in sandals and ate roots on Mount Veritas. Except that this was more intellectual, a happening, to shock the bourgeoisie, if you like. Spontaneous, the abolition of the orderly world. Paintings of horror, paintings of shock, no order. The main thing was to have no order. And so what the Dadaist intellectuals like to do, they love the cabaret, because the cabaret is disorder, except for the socialists. It was supposed to have an orderly message. But they loved this orderly cabaret, and in fact they started a cabaret in Berlin called Cabaret Megalomania. And on this Cabaret Megalomania, there were happenings. You know what that is? A happening is the best way to describe it. But as they like chaos, they hit on a brilliant idea. They hit on the brilliant idea of taking a piece of paper and pasting on it. Instead, said to hell with pictures. Pictures are too rational. Painting is too rational. That's a rational activity. That's a bourgeois activity, all these silly painters. Instead, we will simply cut out things from newspapers and pictures, and we'll just paste them in wild array, you know. A head here, a penis here, you know, a cloth here, somebody doing this here. And so they invented something. They invented photomontage. And that is, I think, their greatest and most lasting thing. They didn't mean to invent it. That was simply a good way of showing chaos. But the result was something, again, which fitted in a way with the film, but they invented. So even if you are, as I know some of you are, people who like happenings, and sort of later-day Dadaists, yes? You might come out, something important might come out of it. Anyhow, to their great surprise, they got something lasting. So most of the Dadaists eventually became communists. Because they wanted to shock the bourgeoisie, this became boring. Don't forget, happenings are boring. Nobody likes to live a chaotic life. We've been in it already, yeah? We've talked about that. It becomes boring to be in each chair. So they wanted direction, and they found it in the Communist Party. The most important one is, of course, the satirist George Grosz. So something second came out of it. Excellent satire. The Dadaists were satirists by nature. As a people who make happenings, you know what is a happening? Yeah? Do I have to explain to you what's a happening? I'm not going to put one on, it's too cold. So, anyway, what you have there for is clear, yes? A happening. All right. So you might say the Dadaists have more effect than these prophets. They had at least photomontage and satire. On both of these things, they had a great thing. So they go into the cabaret. The blue blouses came from the Soviet Union. But something of the Dadaist montage was as well important. More important is the second phenomena, the poet as seer. And more, I think, needs to be said about that. But I'm not going to say very much, because I want you to read till next time what I say in the culture of Western Europe about both Stefan George and D'Annunzio. Because Stefan George and D'Annunzio are the chief poets as seers, and I'm just going to say a brief thing about the creator, again, wallowing in unreason, until I get to Spengler himself. But I think you've forgotten to read The Culture of Western Europe, probably most of you. But remember, I'm not a textbook wire for some. I don't repeat myself. Once you've written a book, you're terribly bored with it and you never want to see it again. Even if it is brilliant. Not brilliant to you, let me tell you that. You're already on to the next book, so this is very boring. Anyhow, however that might be, please read Stefan George and D'Annunzio, would you please, because I want to say a few words about that and tie that up next time and then go to Spengler. But first of all, I'm very happy if you interrupt with questions. Any questions?